Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, and here to help me navigate through some of the big stories from the world of superyachting is the Queen of Cornwall, Georgia Boscawen.
She's back.
She is back from the Galapagos.
From the Galapagos.
So we'll get to the Galapagos in a bit because we've got two big topics to discuss this week. Obviously, Georgia's amazing trip out to the very special islands in the Pacific, the Galapagos, where she swam with sharks and saw some amazing sights. But this week's pod is equal parts dark and light because first we have to talk about Bayesian and the interim MAIB report, which has very recently been published. So I should note at this point, this is only an interim report. When we won't get the full one until at least 12 months after the accident. Obviously, it happened in August last year, so we will not get the full report until at least August. The MAIB, I should explain, stands for the Marine Accident Investigation Branch. It's a UK government body responsible for investigating marine accidents. Obviously, Bayesian didn't sink in the UK. It sank off the north coast of Sicily, but it was a UK-registered vessel, so therefore falls under the responsibility of the MAIB. In this interim report, they have looked at the yacht's design, stability, escape routes, operation, emergency procedures, weather conditions on the 19th of August last year, and what exactly happened that night. So there's a lot of detail to get through, and I don't think it's right unless we dig into most of it, really, because it's such a big story for our industry. A loss of life in a superyacht accident like this is just unprecedented, so it's worth dwelling on it. So we'll talk through what we know happened that night on the 19th of August 2024. And I should tell you at this point that some of these details are quite harrowing, but lots are new to us. So here we go. So on board Bayesian, on the 19th of August last year, were 22 people, 12 guests and 10 crew. The yacht set sail from Milazzo in Sicily on the 14th of August for a cruise around the Aeolian Islands. The intention was to disembark guests on the morning of the 19th of August before the yacht proceeded to Naples for a maintenance period. On the 18th of August, the yacht is anchored at Cefalù or Cefalù on the central northern coast of Sicily, but increasing winds mean the captain decides to motor 25 miles to the west to find shelter off Porticello. They drop anchor at 9:24 off Porticello with the centerboard, the lifting part of the keel box, in the raised or motoring position. The seas are calm with a light wind from the northwest. Guests can see lightning flashes away to the west in the distance, but at this point, it's nothing to worry about. The captain goes to bed after checking the weather again, leaving instructions to be woken if wind speeds increase above 20 knots or if there are any signs the yacht is dragging its anchor. At 12:30 a.m. on the morning of the 19th of August, the last guest goes to bed. On duty, remain a deckhand, on watch, and a stew. At 1 a.m., the second deckhand takes over watch duties, and the wind at this time is blowing no more than 8 knots. At 3 a.m., the deckhand on watch notes that the wind speed has not increased, but the distant thunderstorm, which had been on the horizon, seems to be creeping closer. At 3:30 a.m., two guests wake up but stay in their cabin. At 3:55 a.m., the deckhand on watch videos the approaching storm and posts it to social media. He then goes on deck and closes the forward hatches and cockpit windows to stop the rain, which has started falling, from getting inside the boat. The same deckhand notes at this point that the wind speed has picked up to 30 knots and was broad on the port bow. The boat starts listing and the deckhand suspects the yacht is dragging its anchor. So everything happens very, very suddenly in the next 10 minutes. At 3:57 a.m., it has since been confirmed that the yacht actually was dragging its anchor. At 4 a.m., the deckhand on duty runs below to wake the captain. Together, they return to the flybridge, and around the same time, the chief engineer, whose cabin is aft of the engine room, also wakes up and, being used to being on board a boat in bad weather, starts preparing Bajan for maneuvers under power. The chief officer, chief stew, chef, and remaining stews are also woken by the yacht's motion. They dress and exit the crew accommodation. The yacht is now listing between 10 and 20 degrees to starboard. The owner, Mike Lynch, makes his way to the flybridge and asks if the bad weather will affect their taxi pickup in just a few short hours' time. The chief stew is in the galley securing loose items and makes her way to the upper deck to secure further loose items. The chief officer runs up to the flybridge where the captain tells him to wake the remaining crew members still asleep and get them on deck and standing by. The chef, Ricaldo Thomas, is in the galley stowing cutlery, pots and pans and shouts good morning to passing crew. We know that at this stage, just after 4 a.m., the yacht is dragging at about 1.8 knots. A nearby yacht, the Sir Robert Baden Powell, which is a few hundred meters away, is dragging at the same rate. Two of the guests on board and their baby decide to leave their cabin and head to the saloon. The chief officer goes to confer with the captain again on the flybridge, who asks him to check with the chief engineer, who is now in the wheelhouse, if the engines and pumps are on and if the boat is ready to move under power. The engines are on, the pumps are working, the yacht is ready to move. The owner, Mike Lynch, and the guest couple with the baby arrive in the saloon. The captain prepares to position Bajan into the wind from the flybridge, where the wind has suddenly increased to 70 knots, and suddenly the awning over the flybridge rips off. The point of pointing the yacht into the wind is obviously to minimize the angle of heel and reduce risks to the yacht. It's now 4:06 a.m. It's only 6 minutes since the captain has been woken up and 10 minutes since the boat started dragging its anchor and 11 minutes since the deckhand on duty noted the wind had picked up to 30 knots. Without warning, the boat suddenly and very violently heels 90 degrees to starboard and stays down on its side. People, furniture, everything tumbles across the deck. The generators shut down immediately and emergency lighting comes on. The captain, a guest, the owner, the bosun, and the second stew are injured when they're flung across the deck. The second deckhand is thrown into the sea from the flybridge. Two guests, now fully awake and still in their cabin, use draw units as an improvised ladder to exit their cabin. A stew and the first deckhand climb along the internal walls and make it to the wheelhouse from the crew area. Within seconds, water is coming over the starboard rails and flooding down the internal staircases. The chief engineer gets out through a forward wheelhouse door, helping the first deckhand out before heading aft to launch the EPIRB, which is an emergency beacon. The first deckhand then reaches down through the wheelhouse door and pulls two stews onto the deck. The deckhand can't see anyone else in the wheelhouse, so he and the two stews make their way aft and into the sea. Separately, the chief officer finds Mike Lynch and pushes him through the cascading water up to the skipper on the flybridge. This is the last mention of Mike Lynch in the narrative. He was awake, on deck, and in touch with his crew. We do not know what happened to him after this point. The chief officer and skipper then evacuate two guests via the same flybridge route. The bosun and second deckhand get two more guests out onto the flybridge as well. Bajan is now sinking, and the chief stew, bosun, and second deckhand find themselves stuck in an air pocket in the wheelhouse behind port forward wheelhouse door. With the help of a guest, they are able to get it open and escape. The chief officer, meanwhile, is swept to the back of the saloon and into another air pocket. He dives down to open the rear saloon doors and swim clear. I cannot imagine how terrifying that moment must be. The skipper, still on the flybridge, instructs guests and crew to abandon the vessel and swim clear of the mast and boom. It's now 4:22 a.m. The chief engineer has managed to launch the EPIRB and is sitting on the hull near the rudder. He hears shouts from the sea and swims to the other survivors. The wind at this point has eased, and those in the water note Bajan was only a short distance from the shore. The captain and first deckhand swim back to the yacht to try and release a life raft, but they are unable to. The chief officer, however, succeeds in freeing one, and at 4:24 a.m., the life raft is inflated. It's at this point that the chief stew sees the bow of Bajan rise up and then sink below the surface. First aid is administered to those who are injured, and flares are sent up to alert the nearby boat, Sir Robert Baden-Powell, which launches its tender to pick up survivors from the life raft and search the water for anyone else who made it out. No one did. The incident resulted in the deaths of 6 guests and 1 crew member. It's quite hard to read some of that because a lot of it is based obviously on personal testimony that's been given to the MAIB. And I cannot imagine the terror that people must have been experiencing in those few short minutes. And that's the key phrase, the few short minutes. It happened so, so fast.
And when you see, when you hear the details like that, it is just so harrowing. After so long, we've all been wondering what exactly happened. It's just so terrible that these events are so traumatic and terrible that it's very difficult to listen to.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It was a hard report to read, and the full report, I imagine, will make even harder reading. So the MAIB report also looked into the weather that night, because there's been quite a lot of conjecture about the forecast for that evening. So Meteo France, the Meteo France weather bulletin issued at 9 a.m. on the 18th of August, the morning before Bajan sank, mentioned a deepening low pressure system moving towards the area, but reported seas smooth or light, becoming slight or moderate in the second part of the night. Okay, so no huge red flags there. Italian forecasts at 9 p.m. on the 18th of August predicted persistent rain with thunderstorms accompanied by strong gusts. Italian forecasters updated this with a gale warning for Sardinia and Corsica, with their words, isolated thunderstorms with local gusts for Sicily. So the forecasts spanned benign to gusty, but, you know, there's nothing there that would particularly alarm a 60-meter sailing yacht. Uncomfortable, perhaps, but certainly not dangerous. The UK's Met Office, at the request of the MAIB, investigated conditions further. So the Met Office concluded that a trough of low pressure transited the area over Bajan on the 18th and 19th of August. So bear with me on this one. It noted that there was a large amount of convective available potential energy, or CAPE, in the atmosphere. So this is a measure of the instability in the atmosphere. Higher CAPE values generally indicate a greater potential of strong thunderstorms. The Met Office also reported sufficient wind shear in the atmosphere, with conditions borderline for the development of supercells. What is a supercell? It is an isolated mesocyclonic storm that contains updrafts of wind that rotate around a vertical axis. They can produce highly damaging and sudden winds. High inshore water temperatures may also have contributed energy to the weather system. So satellite imagery since examined by the Met Office indicate that the storm front was developing the properties of a significant supercell with associated downdrafts and near surface winds in excess of 100 miles an hour or 87 knots. A downdraft, for those of you who don't know, is when wind and rain suddenly fall out of a storm. It is incredibly violent and incredibly sudden. So the study by the Met Office said a mesocyclonic storm was highly likely and a supercell was probable. So the MAIB report also looked at Bajan's stability booklet, and this is where it could get a bit controversial. So the stability booklet of a yacht examines the boat's stability at various angles of heel and in various loading conditions. So Bajan's stability booklet showed the yacht's angles of vanishing stability at maximum load, full load, and light load at 91.4, 92.3 and 84.3 degrees, respectively. I should explain, obviously, the angles of vanishing stability, after which point the boat cannot right itself. So at maximum load, 91.4 degrees, full load, 92.3 degrees, and light load, 84.3 degrees. But, and it's a big but, these angles were calculated with the centerboard, or the lifting part of the keel, down. Bajan's centerboard, according to the MAIB report, was elevated. Had the centreboard been down, in theory, it is possible that Beijing would have righted after being knocked down 90 degrees by the storm. But the stability booklet did not contain any information about the angles of vanishing stability or down flooding angle of Beijing with the centreboard raised and the sails put away. The MAIB commissioned the Wolfson Institute in Southampton in the UK, a very renowned institution, to undertake a stability and windage study for Beijing. The study determined that the angle of vanishing stability of Beijing with the centreboard raised and with only 10% consumables on board, fuel, water, etc., was 70.6 degrees. So as it was, there was no hope of Beijing righting itself after being knocked down, given her real angle of vanishing stability was 70.6 degrees with the centreboard up. But none of this, it is important to note, was known to the owner or the crew of Beijing. The MAIB study makes very clear these vulnerabilities were not identified in the stability information book carried on board. Consequently, these vulnerabilities were also unknown to either the owner or the crew of Beijing. The MAIB's words there. The Wolfson unit also looked at Beijing's windage and the effect its 72-meter mast had on the incident, determining that the mast accounted for fully 50% of the total wind heeling moment of the vessel when the wind was exactly on the beam. And the next bit is worth saying slowly. The study indicated that if the wind was blowing directly onto Beijing's beam and the yacht was in a motoring condition with the centreboard up and the sails put away, a gusting wind speed of 63.4 knots would likely result in the vessel capsizing. So 63.4 knots is a lot of wind, but not nearly enough, you would think, to capsize a yacht like Beijing. So let's repeat those numbers quickly. The real AVS of Beijing that night, according to the MAIB, was 70.6 degrees, and the yacht was vulnerable to wind speeds on the beam in excess of 63.4 knots. Given conditions that night, the yacht stood absolutely no chance. It was highly vulnerable, but no one on board knew it. A lot to take in there. So what's going to happen now? The MAIB will issue its full report in due course after the wreck is raised and examined, which will obviously improve investigators' understanding of precisely what happened. The yacht will also include recommendations to improve safety on yachts such as Beijing. I should note at this point, you can keep up with all developments regarding Beijing on the Boat International website. The team here are tracking things very closely and indeed. And it obviously goes without saying that our thoughts, as ever, are with all those who lost loved ones when Beijing sank. A real tragedy for the superyacht industry and everyone on board and their families. And I hope when the final report is published, there are some strong learnings. Right. That was Beijing. That was the interim MAIB report. Queenie, I know this is a huge ask, but can you try and cheer me up?
That's why I'm here.
Cheer me up with the Galapagos.
We had to balance it.
We had to balance it.
And in my jet lag state, I could, you know, I'm a man of the people. That's why I'm here.
So what on earth were you doing in the Galapagos?
So I went to the Galapagos, not just because I want to, in the name of journalism, because it's a really interesting place to cover for us, because the whole point of the Galapagos, or the whole reason why people go to the Galapagos, is that nothing ever changes. So they've managed to preserve this archipelago completely. It's just really extraordinary to see it because nothing has changed in the last 30 years, 100 years or anything. So you go and you see this completely pristine island in the middle of nowhere. So it's really, really cool. But from a super yachting perspective, because it's so protected, people think, well, you can't actually do anything different. So because they have really, obviously the routes are dictated by the marine park and you have certain times that you can go and visit islands and things like that. So it's very strict, obviously in the name of conservation and protecting the islands. However, I went with Cooks and Adventures who we were trying to think out of the box, outside of the box, and trying to find ways to make it really cool and exciting for people that would potentially go there and want something a little bit different.
And were any super yachts there when you were there?
So you have to basically cruise around with a little convoy, like a little flotilla of your group. So while you don't actually socialize, unless you wanted to, I guess, you cruise around in a group of maybe three or four other vessels. And it's a safety regulation, but it also means that they can control where all the yachts are. So you actually don't really see anyone randomly cruising past the horizon.
Okay.
So you can arrange to do it with like tandem charters or whatever. You can arrange to do it with other groups. So we were actually on this boat called Hermes, which is I don't mean to flex, but it was the biggest catamaran in the Galapagos. and it's brand new. So we obviously didn't need to socialize with anyone else, but you don't really see anyone else cruising around unless they're in your group, which is very cool. And even so, you don't ever see anyone else on land at the same time as you, and they plan it so that you're alone, which is cool.
I'm just looking here at your bizarre route to get to the Galapagos.
I know. I was at the lovely.
You're probably the only person ever to do this route.
Okay. So I was actually at the Greek charter show, and obviously I love that show. So I wanted to do it and wanted to be there as long as I possibly could. And I also wanted to go to the Galapagos. So in my mind, and actually not just my mind, we had Cookson very kindly looked over this route with their travel agent. But I had to fly back from Athens. And bear in mind, I was in Nafplio, so that's 2 hours to Athens. Fly back from Athens, having been there for a week. Then have about 3 hours to switch cases. And then I flew from, Athens to London, London to Madrid, Madrid to Quito, then Quito to the Galapagos.
The glamorous life of Boat International's travel editor. There.
Yeah. And it was intense. And on the way back, we pretty much did the same thing, but you go through Colombia. I actually lost my luggage there as well. So not ideal, but I got it back. It's fine. Not enough to dampen any mood for sure. Although it is seriously long. It's a long time. It's a long time to stay upbeat and happy. Flight number four, you're like, okay. Yeah. And also the flights are long. So when you're flying from Quito to the Galapagos, it's a 3 hour flight. So you get there, you arrive in Quito. I'm like, right, we're in Ecuador now. We're here. And then you have to get back on another plane. So it's actually worth, if anyone does do it, it's worth staying in Quito in Ecuador to explore that town for a bit, because it's really cool, really, really beautiful. And it's 2,000 meters above sea level. So you arrive and loads of people actually get altitude sickness in the city. But the city feels, in a weird way, feels a bit like Milan.
Oh, wow.
But in like a really cool South American way. So it's like a blend of the two, because there are these huge cathedrals. And then like the architecture is really interesting, and there are loads of markets in the city. The city itself is a real destination. So it's a cool little extra that we did. On the way back, we did actually stay there. So it's very nice. So I'm sure many people will know this, but for a bit of background, the Galapagos is located 620 miles off the west coast of Ecuador, and it's a volcanic archipelago that is known for its unique and fearless wildlife. There are 13 main islands and 6 smaller ones, and over 100 islets and rocks, most of which are part of the protected Galapagos National Park and also a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The islands are right on the equator, which is why they're so dramatic and really different from one another. So you'll be in one island that's kind of really beachy and beautiful, and then there's another one that's like quite like Scotland and really hot sun. So it's really cool. And obviously, aside from how dramatic and beautiful the landscape is, most people go to the Galapagos for the wildlife, which are completely unfazed by you. And they have loads of endemic species like the aquatic iguana and the blue-footed booby, which I actually have a comment here saying, don't laugh. And you did. Maturity levels are high.
Booby is just a naturally funny word.
Yeah. Well, there are lots of them there.
Okay.
And giant tortoises and, of course, sharks, which I had my very first shark encounter, which is very exciting. And was it positive? I don't know. I can't decide. Have you ever swum with sharks?
Only little ones, scuba diving, various places. You kind of see smallish ones swimming around. Mm-hmm. If I saw a significant one, I'd be swimming very fast in the opposite direction.
Okay. Well, I can't pretend that I wasn't terrified. But something happened to me that I don't think was supposed to happen. And we'll just get into it. Okay. So from the moment you actually step on board, you're told in the Galapagos, you just can't jump in. It's not something that you can do. You can't just like lower the swim platform and hop in because there are sharks everywhere. And the guides will tell you that the sharks here aren't interested in you, but the sharks over there, sorry, the sharks here are interested in you, but the ones over there, 200 meters to the left, aren't. I don't know why. I don't know. I'm sure there's a scientific reason for that. Anyway, I was ready to trust the guides. So there we go. I was a bit skeptical, but we're fine. Anyway, so it's really, really cool. There are hundreds of them. So in the evening, the underwater lights come on and you can see them all swimming around and or circling you. But it was incredible. So there are dedicated places that you can swim in the shallows. And my first encounter, just as we were getting in the water, you know, when you like catch your ankle on like a sharp edge, it's exactly what I did. And it just started bleeding and it bled and bled and bled. And I didn't know what to do. It was really deep, but I don't know why it was bleeding so much, but we just couldn't stop it. And the guides, I think probably after, you know, a couple of minutes were like, well, we really need to go because we've got our dedicated time slot. And it was just bleeding and bleeding and bleeding. And I'm not a scientist, but I know that you shouldn't get in the water when your leg is bleeding profusely.
Especially if there's hundreds of sharks.
Hundreds of sharks. And I have just met these guys. I was there, this is day one. And so I started asking them random questions, sort of technical terms for a certain fish that was nearby, just because I wanted to know if they're actually legit, which of course they are. But I continued and rather panicked, got into the water. And I must say that I learnt a lot about myself in that incident, because we got in and within a few seconds, there's a bloody shark and it was amazing. And I'm so pleased that I saw it. But as someone that thinks that they're quite cool, calm and collected, this is how I reacted. Firstly, I panicked. Obviously panicked, did what you're not supposed to do and started thrashing around and panicking. And then instead of just trying to swim the opposite direction, I grabbed the wonderful Tamsin from Cooks and Adventures, who was the person that basically brought me out to the Galapagos and someone that I like very much, and put her straight in harm's way. So I didn't even think about it. She was there.
So not only were you thrashing around like a wounded, bleeding seal, you decided to endanger your host by shoving her into the giant toothy maw
shark. I didn't
take Tamsin, not me, was your thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I had no problem with it whatsoever. And then my second reaction, which again, for those of you that have swum with sharks, I'm sure that you're not supposed to do this. I just stuck my head up and I stuck my head out of water and then I calmed down, problem solved. So I basically did the exact things that you're not supposed to do and then did the equivalent of burying my head in the sand and then continuing, because that removed the threat. Anyway, I was very cross with my reaction, actually, as the intrepid traveller shown up by what turned out to be a relatively small Galapagos shark. But I'm glad I saw it at the end when the GoPro footage came out. It was... it didn't make it to the reel. I think it showed me up in a bad light, but I was happy with it.
I know who not to stand next to in an emergency situation.
No, because you'll be dead. I have no problem with that at all, apparently. So the other thing on the wildlife front was how unfazed by humans everything is there. So at night, sea lions would clamber onto the swim platform, which is just really wonderful to sit with a glass of wine and see them kind of jostling in and up onto the boat and along with flying fish and more sharks. And yeah, it was really, really cool.
So I've never been to the Galapagos. Mm-hmm. My parents have. And I remember them showing me some photos once just seals sitting on park benches with like some guy reading a book.
Yeah.
Right next, like there's absolutely no fear.
We went to this beautiful beach. And again, it's just so nice to see this with no one else around. Like the whole point of the Galapagos is that even though, you know, more and more people can visit these islands, you won't see other people around. So you'll go and experience this when there's just, you know, four or five of you on the beach. And it's really special. we went to this beautiful beach that was just covered in sea lions and their sea lion pups. And it was just really cool. You kind of have to really be careful to keep your distance because they're everywhere. We also swam with sea lion pups as well. And they come up and sort of nip your legs and play with your fins. And it's just really, really cool. So I was very, very happy to see it. And I also just want to note that I think now is a really interesting time to visit the Galapagos and to cover it, being completely untouched. And there's so much conservation projects that are going on at the moment, something that Cookson actually do take, they have an amazing stance on that. And part of that means that 30 years ago, the Galapagos would have been an incredible place when your parents went, would have been a beautiful, incredible place. Now, the work there that has happened with the giant tortoises or various species of birds is phenomenal. So now is really an incredible time to visit. And it's one of the very few places on Earth that's actually experienced that because it's you know, there's been rewilding projects, there's been pink iguana conservation projects, which Cookson Adventures have actively taken a role in.
I know... It's great that we're talking about this now, and it seems to me that the Galapagos is kind of back on people's agendas because it had a torrid time during COVID. Obviously, with an economy that depends so much on tourism, having no tourists there was pretty devastating to the economy of the islands. And we actually wrote a big feature at the tail end of COVID, speaking to tour operators and charter yacht owners and people from the Ecuadorian government. It was essentially an appeal to go there, you know, as soon as you possibly could, because they are incredibly precious, as you've described. They're very rare. There's no other place like them. And when your economy is so dependent on tourism, obviously you're very susceptible to shocks like COVID. So it's great that we're talking about them. It's great that they seem to be back on the people's agendas.
And
they absolutely should be.
Yachts in particular are so integral to how that works. A really good example of this is when we met one of the Cookson guides that's actually based in the Galapagos called Luis Rodriguez.
This is George's fifth attempt to say that name.
Lewis, I'm so sorry, but that's going to have to do. He's based there, and I've his knowledge is unbelievably impressive. So I've actually never met someone that knows so much about the giant tortoises or anything. It was just so impressive to chat to him. And
how close can you get to the giant tortoises?
2 meters.
Wow.
Yeah, and they really do walk at you. They come and they'll be eating something, and then they'll just walk at you. So it's really, really cool. But he was saying that a really important thing for the giant tortoises is repatriation and making sure that they're in the right place. They should be in the highlands and in very specific places around the Galapagos. And there are actually 13 different species of tortoises on the Galapagos, two of which have gone extinct. But these differ between the islands. But do you have any idea of how they repatriate tortoises, giant tortoises? This is where the yachts come in.
Helicopter.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
They strap them up and they dangle them from the underneath the helicopter and then take them back where they're supposed to be. Take them back.
I'd quite like to see that.
I know, me too. They do it in Switzerland with cows. And now they do it in the Galapagos with tortoises.
Wow.
But the guides that we had were amazing. We had the opportunity to see things at first light and, as I said, swim with sea lion pups and learn about the things in a really clear and detailed way. So it was very impressive. And also Cookson very kindly arranged, if you do a charter with Cookson and the help of Cookson, which is brilliant because they have obviously the contacts, they will bring their amazing photographer, Louis Waite, out with you, who's brilliant. So that's a really nice touch for anyone thinking about doing it. But I'm just blown away by it all. I got back on Wednesday. I'm still jet lagged because it's minus 10 hours, but I would do it a million times over. It was really, really good.
And when can the Boat International audience read all about your adventures in the Galapagos?
September.
Oh, because that's the big adventure issue.
Exactly.
Oh, fantastic.
And it was an adventure.
Well, I look forward to hearing, reading more.
Do you know what's really exciting is that I have a film camera that I take with me when it's really special. And I had 6 rolls of film that I used out there, which actually doesn't seem that much, but it felt like the right amount. And I am just waiting for an email. So I am concentrating, but I'm waiting for an email from the developer to see the photos. But it's very exciting.
Very exciting. Well, I'd like to see those pictures too.
Yeah. Well, I'll show you.
Well, that about wraps it up for this week. We thought we'd just focus on the two big stories, obviously. There's lots of events coming up. I should actually just mention our Volley and Boat International Golf event, which took place last week at a lovely resort called Camaral near Barcelona. It was a fantastic couple of days, playing with captains, brokers, all sorts of people from the industry, shipyards, hacking around a golf course that is much too good for...
You always tell me how good you are at golf.
I've never said those
He words. Always says it.
I've never said those words.
He does that thing where he walks around doing golf moves in the office.
They're cricket shots.
Yeah. They're golf.
It was a great couple of days. Fantastic place, fantastic event. We got Ocean Talks coming up. Speaking of the Galapagos, we got a great event on the... As he hurriedly checks the events diary, it is taking place on the 12th of June in the Serpentine Gallery in London.
I really hope we keep that pause in.
Yeah, no, we can't. That was awful. But the Ocean Talks is a great, great afternoon taking place. Serpentine North Gallery in Hyde Park. It's free to attend. You just need to register. We have some fantastic speakers, some great exhibitors. For anyone who's interested in superyachting and ocean conservation, melding those two worlds, or learning more about amazing places like the Galapagos, Ocean Talks is a really, really good event. So come along. Just register on our website and come along. You'll have a great time and you'll meet some fantastic people. And there's loads more travel, isn't there? Monaco Grand Prix. I'm going to the Monaco Grand Prix.
I know you are.
In a couple of days' time.
Very jealous.
We got a Bermuda event coming up, the Cyclades Cup in Antiparos. Caroline's going out to that, and an event in Newport a few weeks later in June. So it's a busy, busy summer for the Boat International team.
I'm off to Indonesia.
And you're off to Indonesia.
Yeah. The most important, yeah. Again, in the name of journalism.
Classic Queenie. Well, everybody, thank you very much for tuning in this week. We've really enjoyed your company. Thank you, Georgia.
Thank you.
I hope you found it insightful and interesting. So this week's podcast has been a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we will see you next time.